This might be a controversial take, but beyond speculation, I don't think crypto is a product. It's just infrastructure. But given that there has been a waiting risk appetite by a lot of the institutions, that has also dictated the types of infrastructure that they build.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto is a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining another episode of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I'm Max Waddington, joined by Jack, Parth, and Jason. Today we're going to be answering one question, which is why are institutions getting into DeFi? And I personally couldn't think of a better crew to help answer this question. Before we get into that, gentlemen, we have some stories. Parth, I loved your story this week. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I think it's more focused around the topic of today's conversation, which is around DeFi, RWAs. And you know, what we have seen so far is there's been a year-over-year growth of around 315%. So we started out with close to 4 billion in RWAs. And now, right now we're sitting at around 17 to 20 billion. And I think the biggest component here is the rise of non-stablecoin RWAs, which is exactly what we'll talk about today. So on-chain lending, private credit, when we talk about asset-backed loans against real estate, HELOCs, that's the stuff which I'm excited about to touch on.
Awesome. I can touch on the boring stablecoin side, but what wasn't boring was the stablecoin utility report that BVNK, YouGov, and some others shared. It's their 2026 stablecoin utility report. It's like a global study survey on how people use stablecoins. They talk about like ownership trends, spending behavior. And they really made a good case as to like why stablecoins are really becoming part of people's everyday financial lives. So I think it's a great report. Check it out if you can.
Max, I don't know how to react to this. You just called stablecoins boring. 2 years ago, stablecoins would be probably the topic of the town. And now they're boring, which I think is a great sign of maturity because that tells you that crypto is meant to be boring and invisible and something which people don't talk about.
It's because they're not algorithmic anymore.
That's the hot take.
Yes.
The challenge is trying to get people to remember when we started talking about these things back in 2017, 2018, and everyone laughing out of room going, why would we ever want a stable coin?
Jack, I thought you had a really good story. Do you want to wrap up this section with yours?
Yeah, it maybe ties into what we're going to talk about today, which is, I think it's within the past 10 days, is there was three pretty significant announcements around traditional financial institutions in each of these cases, potentially collaborating with, partnering, what I don't know what the term you want to use here is and what the level of commitment actually is, you know, obviously going to be TBD, but also making investments in tokens of respective protocols. The first was on February 10th, Citadel. Layer Zero announced a new blockchain called the Zero blockchain. And they said that, you know, Citadel, DTCC, ICE, which is the owner of New York Stock Exchange, I believe Google as well, are all planning to collaborate with them on this, you know, new exciting, you know, blockchain that they're launching. And that Citadel and ARK Invest were investing in Layer Zero, including, you know, the token itself. The second, a day later, Uniswap came out with an announcement that they were working with BlackRock and Securitize to make BIDL tradable on Uniswap X. So to bring like, you know, on-chain liquidity and usage of BIDL, which is an on-chain money market fund or on-chain treasury access into Uniswap, and that BlackRock would be buying UNI tokens. Again, sort of unclear the level of commitment and how much of this is, you know, Uniswap versus how much of this is actually like BlackRock and Securitize pushing for this. And then the third announcement a couple of days later came from Morpho, where they said they had a cooperation agreement in place with Apollo, and that Apollo had plans to potentially acquire Morpho tokens, and that they were going to work on, you know, integrating. I mean, Apollo already has some funds on chain with Securitize, that they were going to work on, you know, integrations into these, you know, Morpho V2 vaults and borrowing and lending against potentially some of these Apollo assets on chain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that alone highlights or provides some really good context for our discussion. I think, given even before all of this kind of big wave of partnerships, we've seen a lot of the recent narrative really just focus on institutions finally entering DeFi. And I think one of the best ways to approach this, to approach answering this question would be to break it out by like sectors. In Jack's case, we saw some asset managers, some infrastructure providers. I think maybe another group we could touch on is banks as well, because the motivations, I think the timing and like the challenges that each sector needs to overcome are all different and could be some interesting nuance for our listeners. So we can start, you know, kind of wherever you guys want. Maybe we start with the banks, because that we didn't really touch on that yet. Anyone want to provide a little bit of context on what we're seeing the banks do, like what their action is relative to the rest of the institutions entering the market? And then we can dive into what we think about that sector.
I can share with you some of the things that we've seen over the years that have been, I'll say, precursors to a major entry into DeFi. But I think you have to look at what is the profile of the bank to begin with. You know, so their job is very much to facilitate risk management and generation of yield for not just depositors, but shareholders. And we've seen some entities move forward with their own permissioned blockchains and using this technology in some cases as an orchestration layer. And I'd refer to some of what JP Morgan had done with what they called Onyx. Now they have, I believe it's rebranded as Kinexys. They have something they call the tokenized collateral network, where, again, within the bank itself, entities are allowed to borrow cash and essentially pledge tokenized money market fund shares as collateral. We're seeing some similar things happening with Citibank in the Swiss Digital Exchange, where the bank has worked with SDX to essentially tokenize, settle, and do safekeeping of private market assets and provide liquidity in a secondary market there. So I don't know that you necessarily would bucket that one so much as DeFi, but it's tokenized securities and banks working there. And we've seen the likes of banks in the Far East, particularly some that are working with the Monetary Authority of Singapore on something called Project Guardian. So they're looking at tokenized funds, tokenized FX. So moving fiat versus fiat on chain in a tokenized version. And frankly, major way that banks make money is through lending and extension of credit. So I think we are going to see more lending, whether it be through stable coins or digital dollars, that are backed by real world assets that can be tokenized. And in some cases, I think we'll see even utilizing stable coins, whether they be bank issued or otherwise, to facilitate micro duration repurchase agreements to allow for funding in a location at a given time when a client needs it. And instead of moving assets in a 24-hour lockup period, it could be for 2 hours, 3 hours. And you know, think about the reduction in cost from a cross-border correspondent banking network. If you can settle in real time using a fiat representation on chain, that just takes out a tremendous amount of friction and cost.
And maybe Max, to talk about infrastructure providers and how that sector thinks about institutional DeFi, I think it's worth calling out that the story which Jack mentioned about BlackRock now offering DeFi trading on Uniswap X, to me, the most interesting piece was the fact that they also bought some UNI token, which is great, because as a capital allocator, it also validates the infrastructure. And it's, you know, as a whole, we have to keep in mind that BlackRock also operates Aladdin, which is this backend core platform, the system of records for asset managers. So this is an organization which does think about infrastructure fairly closely outside of just providing the products on top of that. One of my core frustrations from this cycle that I would say was that we had one of the biggest tailwinds around institutional capital coming into crypto. And But sadly, we saw that a lot of that capital flew into ETFs or stablecoins, but you didn't see a lot of action in DeFi. And now you're seeing a lot of these corporate chains. So think about Robinhood, Coinbase, Kraken. That's one side of chains. The other ones is core DeFi, the ones that you know you and I talk about, which is Aave, Compound, Uniswap. And sometimes it almost seems like they have two different use cases, different personas, different audience. Like, for example, one use case is around just trading or speculation on the assets, right? So you've seen that a lot in Solana, Hyperliquid in the form of derivatives. But then the second big institutional DeFi use case is around chains like Ethereum or EVM chains, where there is true movement or storage or settlement of digital dollars. And from an infrastructure provider standpoint, I think success to me is when an infrastructure provider is basically running a completely new backend and creating these efficiencies or just doing things better than they were before, instead of just going out and seeking a new crypto native on-chain audience. Like, that's how I think about an infrastructure provider when we think about institutional DeFi.
Parth, I love how you broke that out, because what I think about a lot is these asset managers. We talk about institutions, all right? So it could be an asset manager, it could be a brokerage, could be a bank, could be another type of fund administrator. What are they used to? They're used to regulatory compliance. They're used to understanding what the cost structure is for transacting. And some of the volatility in the cost structure of public chains has been, I'll say, a drag on adoption as firms try to figure out how do they insulate themselves from potential volatility. So I think, to your point, when people come up with new ways of doing things, sometimes when you can effectively remove the volatility of a cost for transact, I think that can be very much appealing. I think as more, tools have become available to ensure regulatory compliance, whether they be AML or KYC functions, whitelisting addresses, the ability, frankly, to codify compliance rules into a given token, that is helping to lower the barrier to adoption. And in a lot of cases, what you're really talking about is getting past the technical component may be easier. It's open questions around policy. And to your point around tailwinds, we now have a regulatory environment in the US, which is much more constructive than it had been a few years back. So you've had some firms, and I would argue our own falls into this bucket, that have been more progressive in learning and trying to anticipate how things may change and doing some investment in time in thinking about how to potentially embrace more of the opportunities that lie ahead. While other firms may have waited to see how things may evolve and are just picking up their momentum from a different starting point. So I think a lot of it comes down to what's the tolerance for risk, what's your capability to do a capital investment in this space, and then frankly, what is your existing business model? Is it at threat and are you defending, or are you on the front foot looking for new opportunistic probabilities where you can take whether new product development or take advantage of more efficient underlying infrastructure? And it's a pretty wide spectrum when you think about the quote unquote institutional bucket.
Yeah. I was just going to jump in and say, you guys, I think I agree with a lot of your points. One of the things we talk about from the venture side a lot is the crypto industry is still, you know, sometimes we get lost in working in this industry, but in the grand scheme of things, it is still simply like way too small compared to, you know, the global financial system. And so, like, if you're coming to this pond to sell users that are like crypto native, and you're this big bank or company, you're sort of like missing the plot, right? That probably won't work. And that's not enough to like to come and sell your existing fund to on-chain crypto users when there's like a couple hundred billion of like non-native crypto assets that sit inside of these blockchains and networks. Instead, it's to the point that Parth was making. It's like using the infrastructure because it brings efficiency and utility and potentially a better operating system. And it does feel like we're starting to see maybe some of that beginning to happen.
This might be a controversial take, but beyond speculation, I don't think crypto is a product. It's just infrastructure. Like, it is an engineering function which is used to manipulate data. And that is what crypto and crypto rails are. But to Jason's point earlier, I think Jason, what's also happened is that given that there has been a varying risk appetite by a lot of the institutions, that has also dictated the types of infrastructure that they build. So this whole debate around permissioned versus public blockchains, I feel like now that debate has kind of been settled where the infrastructure that people are gravitating towards is public. But you have these protocols like Horizon by Aave, or for instance, you have, you know, these kinds of institutional DeFi use cases where you have a small permissioning system, a KYC layer at the application level, as opposed to just the entire blockchain being permissioned where no one has access to it. Would you agree, or do you think it's still debatable?
So first off, to be honest, I think that the separation of the application from the protocol is a very important stepping stone. And I think that is truly, to your point, what is helping some institutions be more comfortable. And you mentioned Aave's Horizon. I believe I saw an article with Stanny from Aave speaking earlier this week saying they've finally crossed, I shouldn't say finally, they have crossed $1 billion worth of real world assets on that platform. And it has not been in market for very long. I think it's about a year now. I will say though, I do think that some institutions are still hemming and hawing about whether they should be on a permission chain, public chain, or what is a hybrid. So I know a lot of institutions are talking about networks and using permission networks for those entities that have similar requirements. So you see Canton as a network, as an example here. It's a layer one. I'm not sure that I would call it permissionless, but I do think that there are a lot of entities that are interested in that because the people behind that project are more familiar with traditional market structure. And I think your point about crypto being infrastructure is incredibly salient because just like the internet is not a product, it is a means of communication. I think crypto rails can be infrastructure. I think the applications are the product. And then the use cases are, in some cases, are services that take advantage of the infrastructure. So I don't think it's completely settled. I do think that the resistance to using public infrastructure is much lower today than it was a few years ago. But I think, you know, one of the questions that people still have, and I say people, when you're coming from a large institution, and Jack, you rightly pointed out that traditional financial services, traditional markets are much, much, much larger. People are thinking about scale and speed of throughput. And then the question about settlement finality. So even though we saw some interesting announcements out of Layer Zero about incredible, as they put it, significant enhancements in their ability to process transactions per second, you still have questions of what will it do in a time of stress? You know, if you're someone like the DTC and you're processing quadrillions of transactions in a given year, you want to know that that infrastructure is sound, is not able to be impeded by some technical hiccup, or frankly, you have to pay more for network congestion fees. So that, I think in many cases, it's the resiliency and the fee questions that are still fueling some of that permission debate.
Yeah, I guess, Jason, I'll switch gears here because I feel like the four of us might be really interested to talk about infrastructure, but majority of the folks don't care about infrastructure as much. I want to talk about something really exciting, which we've been thinking about, and that's on-chain lending, right? So just having a digital twin or a token isn't big enough for traditional finance or finance in general. And the real power is when you have these real-world tokens or assets, which can be used as collateral, and you can, you know, put them to work. So you buy $100,000 worth of tokenized U.S. Treasury bonds, but can I borrow $60,000 by depositing my $100,000 tokenized bonds? And then you get to keep the bonds, but at the same time, you all obviously have this borrowed money. Jack, I'm going to put you on the spot here, but when you think about normal crypto lending, like on Aave or Compound, it works fantastic for assets like Ethereum or Bitcoin, which are essentially crypto native assets. And the reason for that is when you think about real world assets, they don't move in price every second. In case someone defaults, the liquidation process happens really slow. There is legal triggers around that. What are you seeing from your perspective on the on-chain lending markets?
Yeah, I think maybe another way to phrase it is, like, in particular for lending, like the ability to atomically create and redeem and trade these assets. Like if you want to, you know, use Aave and there's a, you know, a 75% LTV ratio in a given market and you're doing it against, you know, Steeth or, you know, some type of like highly liquid asset on chain, you can use, you know, like essentially flash loans and you can taper up to a degree of leverage that you want to take. So if you want to be, you know, 2x, 3x, 4x, 5x leverage, like you can do that in a single transaction or bundled set of transactions that all can occur like relatively seamlessly on chain because the assets themselves are like natively on chain and they have very deep liquid secondary markets on chain. The problem that you have with RWA assets, especially when they're just coming on chain now, is that the collateral lives natively off chain. And so we're dealing with this whole like, how do you bridge assets that live off chain, that have different settlement timelines, where you have to bring, like, there's all these pieces of infrastructure that have to start to be assembled. And I think like, it's one thing to just tokenize an asset on chain. It's another to derive like utility from DeFi in a safe manner. I think we're just starting to like figure that out and put some of those pieces together. So like if I think of what's the core, some of the core pieces of infrastructure that you need for this to happen, we need tokenization platforms that can create and redeem the assets in a primary market in like a succinct way. And it depends. A lot of times for like tokenized funds, it may not be a single day settlement. It may be a week, a month, a quarter even. And that adds duration to creating a new asset and redeeming it. And so if you want to like apply recursive leverage on an asset that has a quarterly redemption timeline and it has a 75% LTV ratio, like to get up to 3 or 4 or 5x leverage, if you actually want to do that, which people show demand to do that on the atomically redeemable assets on chain, it's going to take 4, 5, 6 quarters. So it's essentially impossible to do it. So it dampens the degree of like utility and the amount of leverage that you can take on chain. And so people are like trying to create solutions around that. You need your verification of the assets or proof of reserves. So there's firms like Accountable. They're trying to like solve for this. You need oracles. You need oracles, you know, for in any instance, but they need to feed, you know, real-time prices of these assets. It's particularly relevant for like private funds. And then you have like a net asset value and who are you entrusting that's actually marking these assets? And then are you feeding the price back in, you know, on a live basis? So there's those considerations. And then for protocols that are offering leverage, you do need to make sure that you have market makers or somebody there that will liquidate assets with some type of reasonable liquidation penalty. So if an asset has some degree of duration, they have to be willing to take that on their balance sheet until they can redeem and sell the asset. And so that's something, again, those are all pieces that have to be figured out. So it's not just like, oh, we can just tokenize assets and easily integrate them. You're starting to see over the past year, clearly it looks like there's demand for this on Aave Horizon and in some of these Morpho vaults and Morpho pushing for V2 is going to continue to like kind of focus on RWAs. It seems like they're all focused on this, but there's a lot of pieces of infrastructure that have to start to orchestrate together.
Do you know there's a word on what you just described, the borrowing against the same real world collateral again and again? It's called loop maxing. That's what I saw on Twitter. Like you're looping into the same asset again and again. But I think, Jack, you bring up a really good point that right now we're seeing the happy path of tokenization, but there is a lot of big components which have to be built around it. So I could almost see a service which is only focused on redemptions, for instance, or people can build credit default swaps. So insurance-like products where in case, you know, the real world asset is, you're not able to pay back the loan, what happens to it after? So I think you're spot on about the fact that there will be this infrastructure component around this, the happy tokenization path.
Yeah, totally.
And Parth, just to build really quick on what you're talking about from a derivative perspective, you know, the SEC came out recently, I think it was January 26th, with some taxonomy guidance around tokenized securities. So, you know, they talked about you can have an issuer sponsored tokenized security where that issuer does it themselves or they hire somebody to do it on their behalf. They have third party sponsored tokens. So imagine you've got units in an account and you ask somebody to convert those units, segregate them, hold them to Jack's point around proof of reserve, and then create a claim via, or basically an entitlement to those underlying assets through a token is one thing. The last bucket that they talk about is actually synthetic security tokens. So, you know, you could have a vehicle like a credit default swap or a reference linked swap where you basically create the exposure and tie it to some asset that neither party might own, you know? So when you have those reference, like I'll give you an example, municipal bonds, you know, there are a lot of credit default swaps that are created and they reference a municipal bond. It could be from an issuer. It could be a monoline insurer. So the understanding what you actually own, is it the issue that's referenced or is it the insurer that's referenced in that case? In one case, one might be the target that you're watching to see the outcome. The other case, it might be an entire class of bonds that would be issued by or covered by a monoline insurer in that case. So for example, I think I have a reference to Parth debt, but in fact, it's Jack who is covering a group of different issuers and it could be Max debt. So even though Parth doesn't default, Max does, all of a sudden Jack puts it to me and I've got to pay. I'm like, I didn't know I had that exposure. So getting to the details and, you know, giving that sort of extreme example, what is very critical is understanding what are the entitlements and what are the property rights that travel with that particular token, because that will determine whether or not it is in fact providing the economic exposure somebody thinks it does. And from a lending perspective, whether or not that collateral is actually something that you can value. The duration risk you raised, Jack, great point. You know, these are markets that move in milliseconds. I mean, like no joke, hundreds of milliseconds to add a block. And you've got all these different entities that are trying to take advantage of micro ticks and speed to market. So I think it's really going to be interesting to see how that continues to evolve, but it is progress in the way that people are understanding it. And I think that more use cases get out there, the more people understand it, the easier it's going to be to think about how do you develop the right types of controls that would allow people to take advantage of the infrastructure.
Jason, to your example around you not knowing what the risk is around, like if there are debts which are wrapped on top of each other, when we think about why institutional DeFi works, people talk about auditability, transparency, 24/7. But I think the biggest core use case is that you can price risk better. That is what matters at the end of the day. The reason why people like Morpho is because you know as a user exactly where your collateral is, and every single user can audit at any point of time on where the money is. And that means I can have a better risk engine against that. And that kind of is the core thesis of institutional DeFi as well.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
All right. Looks like we're at time. What a conversation, guys. It sounds like the tech and the regulatory clarity that you mentioned, Jason, sparking like a number of partnerships that we've seen from our stories and topics this week. From Jack's point of view, there's a lot of ongoing investment to try to like continue bridging that gap between on-chain and the real world. Parth, personally, I think the debate is still TBD on the public versus permission chains, but time will tell. It seems like a tight race and should be fun to watch. So, gentlemen, it was a pleasure as always, and thank you so much to our listeners as well.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution would or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2026 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.